Come in, come in. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll start. There's still one or two coming in the back door, but we're doing well. We set up about 72 chairs, and we're sure about 70 right now. So it's a great crowd. Nice to have this kind of interest in local history, whether you're from the regional group or whether you're from North Dumfries Preservation Society. I can't even remember the name of our own group. How many here are from North Dumfries tonight? Can you put your hand up? Good. How many people here from the greater region that have come through the WHS? You know, it's just about half of each. So what a great opportunity it is for us to meet together and share a little bit about history for a little bit over an hour and a half tonight. Sort of makes me thankful for the tornado that came by about a month and a half ago. Sorry, John. I took John's joke. I didn't say anything about a tornado. No. No, that's fine. Because certainly it's nice to have everybody mixed together. I'm Dave Piper. I'm the chair of the North Dumfries Historical Preservation Society. And I've been that since we started in 2013. And we were an outgrowth of the 2012 International Plowing Match. And from the plowing match, where we had a historic theme for Waterloo Region, we developed history boards that you'll see in the town hall or in the community center up there. And the gal who was responsible for developing all of that is our first speaker tonight, Rachel Redshaw. Rachel was our office manager during that time. And after the plowing match was over, she and I got talking and we thought, we need to do something about history. We need to do something about archives. We didn't have an archive. And while some stuff was stored at the old township office, it wasn't really stored well, and we basically had to rescue it. And the township came to our rescue to a degree by giving us an office and some storage space in the community center, North Dumfries Community Center, just over here. And we are still there at this point. We're certainly looking to move to a larger space. We're going to talk a little bit about more about that at the end of the night. So we have a board of directors. We're newly incorporated. And this was our first meeting as an incorporated organization. And we wanted to do something to bring people back. Over the pandemic, we lost touch with many of our members. We didn't have a lot that we could do together the same way. The last couple of years, we've started to pull that back together. We see incorporation as a bit of a new start for us. If you would like to become a member, it's $20. Our memberships are on sale over here today. And there's a small newsletter for you if you decide to sign up. You'll be able to come to our meetings and vote on any of the matters that come up, and you'll get your newsletter on a regular basis. The gal over here trying to distract me with the camera, well, that's Kim Bonney. Kim is our treasurer. She wanted me to remind you that we take donations. And they have one of those little credit card readers to help you with that if that's something you really want. So we have two speakers tonight and two groups meeting tonight. And I'm going to call up John Glass, who's the chair of the Waterloo Historical Society, and he's going to welcome you on behalf of that organization.
Well, thanks, everybody. It's great to be here. Wow, it's the biggest applause I've ever had in my life. Yeah, we're happy to be here. We were going to be here about a month ago, and there was some kerfuffle with wind and water or something. We were going to be in the park, and David got in touch with us. We had to cancel our event. Smart. And Rich still wanted to show up just to make sure that if anybody showed up, we'd be able to tell them that, hey, the event is canceled. But seeing our heads prevailed, and we just stayed at home. And, our group is much the same as yours. We're about 100 years older.
You.
I feel like the group is 100 years older. We're in about our 112th year. It was started by a bunch of old guys, I think, sitting around one day saying, hey, we should really start thinking about our heritage and history and start documenting it. And every year since 1913, we've put out an annual volume. We call this our award-winning volume. We won some award 30 years ago or something like that from the government, but it's something that it's a great resource for anything around the region. for doing history. A lot of it's online. Our membership is a little bit more expensive. We're $30, but everybody does get a copy of the annual volume. For the foreseeable future, we're still hard copy. So that's one of our benefits as well. So I just want to thank everyone for coming out from both sides. I think we probably got a fairly good representation of the region here, and happy to be a guest, and I'm thankful that you invited us. And maybe we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, agreed.
Thanks.
Rich, have you guys got anything you're selling tonight?
Apart from ourselves.
I'm not going to talk about that, but...
Yeah, we got the annual volumes, a couple of Myth River tour books, some regional postcards. So, yeah, see us afterwards.
Okay, so there's some items up here, souvenirs for tonight if you're interested, historical souvenirs. And at the back, we have stuff from North Dumfries. We put out this year a 200th anniversary calendar for Ayr's 200th birthday, which was just this year and has been celebrating all year. These were $20. They are now $5, surprisingly. But they got some great pictures. So for $5, you might want one. And the Ayr 200 organization is here with their material tonight. And they have some attire that you might find interesting as well. So the purpose of the meeting tonight is to share historical thoughts, ideas, different perspectives. Rachel's going to talk specifically about early history in Ayr. And Ken's going to talk a little bit more about something a little larger. What do we do with the stuff that we have, that we save, that we want to keep, that's historically important for our community? We're going to be about an hour and a half. I told you where the washrooms were. We're going to take a 10-minute break after Rachel, just because the bar might need it, you might need it, and you might need the washrooms. But just very brief, 10 minutes, and then we'll move on. Oh, and our Mayor of North Dumfries has arrived. Thank you, Mayor, for coming tonight. You're supposed to applaud the Mayor. Okay, John, if you would like to introduce Rachel, we'll get started.
So when I was talking about our canceled event, Rachel was one of our feature speakers, and happily the work she did, she'll be able to present it with you tonight. I'll tell you a little bit about Rachel. She was raised here, right here in Ayr, and for several years she sat on various heritage committees in North Dumfries, and she also wrote a regular column in the Ayr News, and that column was on historical matters. She has several degrees in the fields of protecting and conserving cultural and heritage resources, and she is currently an associate and also a senior heritage planner with MHBC Planning. So I'd like to introduce Rachel, and let's welcome her here.
Thank you for that introduction. So good evening. It's an honor to be here. As you mentioned, I did grow up in the village of Ayr, and I spent a lot of time researching the township and the village. So I'm very excited today to take you through. It's going to be brief, but a brief journey through the evolution of the area and where it all began. So resetting up characters and sets which play a part in the story in celebration of our 200th year anniversary. So I'm going to be looking at three different sections. Sorry if I'm talking fast, but I'm going to go through a lot of history here. So buckle up. So we're going to talk a little bit about Indigenous communities because it does provide a context. People did live here for thousands of years before the village came to be. And then we're going to jump into the 19th and 20th centuries and look at the establishment of the village of Ayr. So before I dive in, I would like to make a traditional acknowledgement. We are located on the shared traditional territory of the Neutral Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples. This land is part of the Dish with One Spoon Treaty between the Haudenosaunee Anishinaabe peoples and symbolizes the agreement to share, protect our resources and not to engage in conflict. We acknowledge the enduring presence, knowledge, and philosophies of Indigenous peoples and the continuing accomplishments and contributions Indigenous people make in shaping our community. So with that, we're going to dive into our first scene. This is Indigenous communities. So we're going to be quick, but one of the earliest artifacts that we have is from the Archaic period. It's between 2000 and 3000 BC, and it was a butterfly stone, which was found just northeast of Ayr on the Edgar Farm. It was believed to be used as a canterweight for spear throwers and described as being designed with a high degree of skill. Now, it's part of the Royal Ontario Museum collection now. So if we're looking at the Waterloo Region Archaeological Master Plan, it's from 1989, so it's a bit dated, dates myself. And at that time, they identified one middle archaic campsite, two late archaic campsites, two late woodland campsites, and one village in North Dumfries. And again, that's dated at this point. Just recently in 2020, just north of Roseville, when they were doing work along Fisher-Hallman Road, they recovered around 35,000 artifacts and remnants of about 20 longhouses. So it's clear, again, that people were living in this area and living within close proximity of the village of Ayr. Now, you may ask, who was living in these villages? Well, the area was controlled in the woodland period by the Neutral Confederacy, which was a large and powerful branch of the Huron-Iroquois family. Now, they're called Neutrals because of the Europeans, because they controlled the quarries from which flint came to make arrowheads. So they were called Neutral by the Europeans because they produced weapons for the Iroquois and the Huron, who were constantly at battle, even before the Europeans came. Another name for them was Anturondiron, meaning the peoples of a slightly different language. They were people of the Longhouse. They were here in Iroquois, but they would have had perhaps a slightly different dialect. And in terms of what they called themselves, we don't actually really know. Some people think it was Chinoncton, which means people who tend or manage the deer, but we're not sure. Could have just been one of the several Neutral nations. Now, they were claimed to be the largest Indigenous society living in the eastern woodlands. In the early 1600s, they had a population of about 40,000. Now, unfortunately, with many First Nation groups, by the 17th century, they encountered several unfortunate events. So we have a famine, we have disease, so smallpox. They also had intertribal war. To say they were Neutrals and they didn't have any foes or enemies is complete rubbish. They certainly did have intertribal wars with other Iroquois nations. And they also had a bitter foe, an Algonquin-speaking Miskuten or Fire Nation tribe, which originally from the Michigan-Ohio area. Now, one of the key changes here is they lost their political position as the middlemen. So they produce weapons for the Huron and the Iroquois. But at this point, the Europeans have come in. The French are providing weapons to the Hurons, and the British and Dutch are providing weapons to the Iroquois, thus minusing out that very important political position. So we know by the 1640s they had a significant decrease in their population and they're in a bit of a vulnerable state. So sort of as a last hurrah, they have a warrior, they call it Paramount Warrior Priest Chief, known as Sue Harrison, and he's in English that would be the Child of the Sun. Now he unites these nations in this vulnerable state, but unfortunately in 1646 he dies. And in the following year, in the summer of 1647, we have the destruction of Huronia. So the British persuade the Iroquois to attack the Hurons, which wouldn't have taken much because, as an Oshawican woman once said, it was a Hiroshima-like relationship. And, of course, after attacking the Hurons, they then turned on the Neutrals, killing many, and the remaining nations dispersed, and many of which went into the United States. So that's closing our first scene, and just to be clear, that people certainly lived in the area, which is going to be a little bit different than what the Europeans are going to describe it as in a second here. So we're moving into our next scene. We're now at 1784 with the Haldimand Proclamation, which granted the Grand River Valley to the Six Nations. So the Six Nations under Joseph Brant sold Block 1, which is going to become Dumfries Township, and it was sold to Philip Stedman of Niagara for about 8,800 pounds and about 94,000 acres of land. Sounds like a good deal to me. So at the time, we have a description of the area. It's very dramatic. And they describe the area as a broken wilderness with large and tolerably well-behaved bears, not bad, fierce and stealthy lynx and wildcats and innumerable roving wolves. So Stedman passes away, and the block goes to his sister, Mrs. John Sparkman. Now, she's not interested in settling this area, so she sells it in 1811 to a wealthy merchant, Thomas Clark, which some of you research may have come across. Now, I say he's wealthy, but in 1816, he's unable to make the payments. And so he sells the block to none other than the Honorable William Dixon for £24,000, so three times the cost that originally was sold for. Now, William Dixon, he's a jack of all trades. He's a businessman, he's a lawyer, an officer holder, justice of the peace, colonizer, merchant, even said to have built the first brick house in the Niagara Peninsula at the ripe age of 21. So he's quite the guy. He was born in 1769 in Dumfries, Scotland. That's where we're getting the name Dumfries. And he was very much involved in the happenings of Upper Canada. So he arrived in Niagara in 1792, and by 1795, he was a native land agent. And he facilitated many transactions in the area, including the transaction of Block 2, which you might be aware of with Mr. Beasley. When he's purchasing this land, he's not coming out of nowhere. He's very much aware of the transactions that are taking place and what's happening in the area. Now, in the same year that he purchases the block, he held a position of chairman of the quarter session of the Niagara District, and he was advertising for tenders for the construction of a courthouse and jail in the village of Niagara. And none other than the young carpenter, Absalom Shade, decides to put his bid in. Now, Absalom was from the town of Buffalo. He's pursuing a career as a builder. He's a son of a farmer and the youngest son of a numerous family. So we see him as a bit of an underdog. And he was 22 years old, Pennsylvania, German, and Deutsch. Now, he failed to get the contract, but blessing in disguise, Dixon was so attracted by his appearance and enterprising spirit that he decided to take him on his mission to carve out a fortune in the wilderness of Dumfries. Now, Shade is quite a guy. I don't have time to go through the descriptions, but he seemed to be quite the character. Just a couple descriptions. They say his appearance was striking. He was tall and wiry, straight as an arrow, with regular and sharp features, more particularly the nose, the whole face being lit up with the sharpest of bluish gray eyes. In short, he possessed a temperament and formation of body and head rarely dissociated with mental and physical strength and acuteness. And another description says he looked every inch of him the typical live Yankee, minus the dyspepsia, slang, and tobacco. So sounds like a catch to me. So we're going to end that scene, and these two guys are going to be planning their adventure out to carve out their fortune in Dumfries. So we're into our next scene. They're embarking on their journey, Shade and Dixon. Now, the only neighboring settlement was in the township of Waterloo with our Pennsylvania settlers. Other than that, it's described as a broken forest and some squatters. So here they are, these two men. Now, you see the porches of them. They look quite surly in their porches, but we have to imagine them. They're traipsing through the unbroken forest here. And Shade and Dixon travel along Governor's Road, which was an indigenous trail, and they make their way into Dumfries, and they meet an indigenous guide along the way. Now, at one point, Dixon actually goes to Flamborough, and Shade goes to the westerly limits of the township, which takes him to what would be the village of Ayr. And he's actually the first person to note it being a prime location for operations, and he's the first one to reserve land in the area, and it's in the area of Niffil, which we'll find out later does become part of the village of Ayr. So we're going to close that scene, and we're going to look at some of the first settlers quickly that were in the area. Now, of course, we have our Pennsylvania Mennonites that are coming into the township in the northwest side, but there's another group that's going to come in. And in 1816, the same year that Dixon purchases the lot, he has his ducks in a row, and he gets a surveyor, Adrian Marlette of Ancaster, and he's going to go out and survey the area, which we're going to see is going to come out in 1822. Now, with him is Scottish Highlander William Mackenzie, and he is from New York State. Now, he's so enamored by the place that when he goes back home, he tells his buddies to come up with him the following year. And so that's what they do. So there's a group of Highlanders that are coming up to settle in the area. Now, most of them are going into the area of Branchton. Now, again, they're from the Gaeltacht. They're Highlanders. They're speaking Gaelic, which is a Celtic or Goidelic language. And they're probably of Catholic religion, which is going to be different than our Lowlanders that are from the Gaeltacht that are going to come a little bit later. And we do have some texts from them which demonstrate that they spoke Gaelic, because we see words like Kimirahashu, which is Harai Ushkabeh, which is water of life. Anybody knows what that is and what that would be? Whiskey. It's whiskey. Pibroch, pipe music, and Felic Beck, which is kilt. So here we have our Highlanders coming in, and one family of which actually herded their cattle from New York State, and they vouched they would never do it again. So we're getting to the end of this scene. In 1819, Dixon makes a bargain with Mr. Telfer and says, I will give you land if you go back to the lowlands and you recruit some people to come settle in my township. So Mr. Telfer is described as intelligent and industrious. He has a colleague, Michael Knox, who's going to help him out. And Michael is described as shiftless and addicted to alcohol. So here we go. Now, their efforts are going to pay off. Okay, now we're getting into our next scene. It's a very important scene. It's in 1824. Hooray! First scene here of Village of Ayr. We have Abel Mudge. Now he's trudging along a rough trail between the township line of Brant and Oxford. And he is at the intersection of Nith River, which was known as Smith's Creek, and Cedar Creek, and there he starts establishing his sawmill and grist mill. Now, just to give a little bit of background, Mudge's family is not new to the area. They came here in the late 1700s, and they're of English descent. They established Mudge's Hollow, which became Canning, so he's well aware of the milling operations, and I don't think he stumbled upon the place, to be honest. I think he may have got a tip. Now, Mudge is a squatter, and he's squatter for some time, but he does establish his mills, and he establishes what we call Mudge's Mills. Now, in 1826, he petitions to have a road constructed or laid out between Roseville and Ayr, which is just outside our door, which is Northumberland Street. And we know at the time that that was laid out, there was also the beginnings of Piper and Stanley Street. And we're going to sort of end this scene. In 1832, Abel does pass away. It does go to one of his sons. Now, his sons are not interested in the milling operations. And it's a very important time because we're going to see this is a key moment because we're going to start seeing a huge influx of immigration. There's a lot going on. They're starting to work on their infrastructure. We even have Dixon paying people in whiskey to raise bridges. So what a time to be there in the Village of Ayr. So our next scene, there is a steady influx of Scottish immigration happening between 1831 and 1832. And this is happening throughout Upper Canada, but particularly in this area. And we're getting families with surnames like Hall, Edgar, Black, Morton, Guthrie, Masons, Hopes, Currys, Wileys, Howells, Robsons, and Mitchells, just to name a few. You might notice that some of our names in Ayr are named after these people. And we do have a group coming from Ayrshire on the west coast and Roxburghshire on the east coast. So I'm not sure if Knox took one side and Telfer took the other, but we have two different groups from opposing sides of Scotland coming in to the area. So our next scene is in the 1830s. So in addition to Mudge's Mills, we have two other settlements that are starting. Okay, we have Jedburgh, which happens to be to the east of Ayr, and we have Nithvale to the west. Now, Jedburgh was established in 1832 by John Hall. He established a flour mill and a distillery, and this is the northeast part of the Village of Ayr now. And he later there was a distillery and a woolen mill and a blacksmith there. The land that he had purchased was a 75-acre parcel of land that included what is now the flooded Jedburgh Dam. Now, to the west, we have Nithvale, established around the same time in the early 1830s. And there, a flour and two sawmills were erected in the 1830s, and that was located 1 mile up the Nith River from Mudge's Mills. Now, they had their time in the limelight because in 1837, they were the meeting and drilling place for the rebel followers of Sir William Lloyd Mackenzie. And tradition has it, when arrests of the ringleaders were to be made in the area, the wife of one such person escaped the running pursuit of an arresting officer. She escaped in time to notify her husband of the situation, and they escaped arrest together, and they were never again to be seen. So in 1834, we have a description of Mudge's Mills, and they describe it as unusually intelligent and active one. I don't know what it means to be unusually intelligent, but I will take it as a compliment. Mudge's debt was taken over by James Jackson, and James Jackson is from Ayrshire in Scotland. And so by the late 1830s, we're now looking at the name of Ayr. So just to be clear, the name of Ayr has not yet come to play. It's Mudge's Mills, and we have Jedburgh and Netheril. So in 1839, apparently, because some people dispute this, Mudge's Mills was formally laid out for settlement by Robert Wiley. So Robert Wiley was a West Coast Scotsman. He was a stonemason, an auctioneer, apparently also a life insurance agent, many things, a storekeeper as well. Very important in the development of the village. Now, of course, at this time, it's very important to establish a post office. It's very important to put your X on the map, your directories and gazetteers. So that's what they're going to do. Now, it makes sense for John Hall that it be called Jedburgh. Why not? It's a good Scottish name. We already have a name that's in place. He's got a growing settlement. But to his dismay, Robert Wiley has the audacity to call it Ayr. And, of course, Robert Wiley is from Ayrshire. So it is called Ayr, and it renames Mudge's Mills to Ayr. So to be clear, at this point, we have Ayr, which was formerly Mudge's Mills, and Netheril and Jedburgh. So, of course, by the end of the 1830s and 40s, because of that significant increase in Scottish immigration, we really start seeing the village growing. And by 1840s, we really start seeing the village take shape. We see infrastructure, key businesses. Mr. Hall with James Jackson confirms the location of Wrigley Road. It turns into Scott Street. We know just in terms of context, Greenfield Village was being established around that time, which never became part of the urban boundary of Ayr. And by 1845, Mudge's Mills is sold to Mr. James K. Andrews, who's the stepson of Absalom Shade. Now, in 1846, we had the Smith's Canadian Gazetteer give us some information on our settlements here. So the village of Ayr has a population of 230 persons. It has two churches, a post office, a grist mill, fully mill, carding mill, tannery, two stores, blacksmith, two shoemakers, two tailors, one cooper, two carpenters, and a partridge in a pear tree. No, a lot of things going on. Now, Jedburgh, if anyone wants to take a guess here what the population is in Jedburgh, its rival, it's only 30. Oh, so it's not doing as well. He's got a pig factory, a blacksmith shop, a store, and a sawmill. And it says that Netheril is the slowest of the three villages to develop. So I'm not sure what that means. If it's less than 30, it can't be that many. And there we have a pig factory, a chair factory built by the Gladstone family. Now, by 1847, the stepson of Absalom Shade sells Mudge's Mills to Daniel Manley. Daniel Manley is an Irish Catholic. He's probably got a bit more in common with those Highlanders. And he even sets a lot aside for a Roman Catholic church, which was built on Gibson Street. There were several parcels, other parcels of land being sold at the time, and we're going to see in a little bit later that the land is being surveyed and lots are being created, which we're going to see the result of that in the 1860s. So in 1847, when Daniel Manley purchases the land, he also builds his own woolen mill. We have William Baker's store, which was a key store on Northumberland Street. And, of course, we have John Watson's foundry, or Ayr Agricultural Works at Church Street and Piper Street. And if you know, it could be a whole other talk. There's a lot of history around that. Very important in the branding and naming of the village. Of course, it became internationally known and is one of the largest employers in the township. So that's really important because that speaks to the population growth. Of course, we need to have a workforce to support that factory or foundry. Now, by 1849, the village of Ayr has now grown to 700. Done doing pretty well. Established a newspaper, a library, and by the end of the 40s and into the 50s, like I said, this is a time where we see Robson and Manley and Jackson, a lot of these key guys, selling large portions of land that are being surveyed into lots. Okay, so we're getting through this, guys. We're at least halfway there. So we're into the 1850s. This is going to be about local government. Now we got a lot of population. We got our infrastructure. It's probably a good idea to have a good governance model in place. So by 1850, we have the Corporation of Dumfries. And in 1852, we have the separation of Dumfries. So North Dumfries goes to Waterloo County and South Dumfries goes to Brant County. And in 1852, we have establishment of the Council of North Dumfries. We have some key players here. Dr. Charles McGeorge, he was the Reeve, and we'll talk about him in a second. Duncan Ferguson, Alexander Buchanan, Highlanders, Robert Cranston, a Lowlander, and David Shantz, Pennsylvania Mennonite. So at this point in time, there's a bit of chit-chat about the incorporation of Ayr. And John Hall is not liking it. So he actually commissions to have a plan of Jedburgh done by James Black. Apparently, anecdote says the original is in the Hall farmhouse, so if anybody knows, I'd like to see it. Hall Street was sectioned off by lots at this point in time. So we have Hall Street, the north end, south side, and we have Main Street with the west and east side. And, of course, the gristmill is downstream and the sawmill is upstream. So at the end of the 1850s, there's been a lot of chit-chat about the incorporation of Ayr. Dr. Charles McGeorge makes a petition to the legislature of the province asking if the village can be incorporated. Now, there were two doctors in town. There was Dr. Charles McGeorge and there was Dr. William Bell, and they happened to bump heads. They did not agree on this, and Dr. William Bell was against the incorporation for whatever reason, and he petitioned against it. And so because of that, it was determined that a great difference of opinion exists among the inhabitants as to the prosperity of the proposed incorporation, and the legislator took no further action. So a bit of a blow, and this is 1857, so it's not until 1884, which we'll see, that we actually become incorporated. So we're getting to the end here. In the 1860s, we really see the village growing, and we have a great map. It's a Tremaine map of 1861, which gives us a detailed view of the village of Ayr. Now, I don't know if it's a poke at John Hall, because it does include a little bit of Jedburgh in there. It doesn't include Nithville, but we can see at this point that the downtown is actually quite densely populated. We have our woolen factory, which is Manley's, wagon shops, hotels, and stores in the downtown area. So it's doing quite well at that time. And some of our key players, of course, are Robert Wiley, William Baker, Dr. Charles McGeorge, Dr. William Bell, and James Piper, who operated the Nithville Mill, just to name a few names. Now, just sort of to close this, but we haven't talked much about Mudge. But by the 1860s or after the 1860s, we don't hear much about the Mudge family. And people say it may have had to do with Lou. Now, Lou was a bit of a gangster. He liked to hang out at Blackrest Corner. So if you're going up to the highway, it's at Cedar Creek and Northumberland. And apparently he used to like to hang out at the tavern there and jump people. And eventually he was pushed out. He went to Wisconsin, and story has it that he pretended to be a member of the clergy. For whatever reason, I'm not going to ask, probably a story for another day, but we don't hear much about the Mudge family after that. And so by the late 1860s, Daniel Manley, our Irish Catholic, he sells his land, his water rights, and a mill race across Stanley Street to John Watson, whose factory or business is doing very well, and Manley ends up actually immigrating to the United States. And by the end of the 1860s, Ayr's population is peaked around 1,000. Okay, so we're almost done, guys. We're almost here. This is called The Last Stand, okay, the 1870s. Now, 1871, John Hall passes away. Still's got some strong supporters here. In 1875, they survey the map of the village of Ayr, which is prepared by James Black, who happened to actually do John Hall's survey in 1852. And the audacity, they include Jedburgh. And so the inhabitants are outraged. Of course, they are not part of Ayr, and they're not liable for a share of the cost. Don't blame them. So they actually had their taxes refunded at this point, and Jedburgh was taken out of the survey. And so getting to the end of the 1870s, we have the Credit Valley Railway, very important factor here in the development of the village of Ayr. And it's actually at this time that the Roman Catholic Church that Manley constructed was last used by apparently a gang of Italians who were working on the railway. And after that, it was removed. So we're into our last scene. It's the 1880s, 1890s. And, of course, in 1881, we have the Illustrated Historical Atlas of the County of Waterloo. And it just happens, guys, that they do include Jedburgh in this one. So it's a foreshadowing, perhaps. So by 1884, we finally have the long-awaited incorporation of the village of Ayr. So this is finally the amalgamation of Nithville and Jedburgh. Some people like to think that they were part of Ayr, but the documents talk about to and from, and there's a clear indication that they were still considered separate entities. There's a quote, it says, "It's doubtful if even yet the village has achieved complete integration of the Jedburgh group." But I think that may not be the case, hopefully, anymore. In 1884, John Watson became the first reeve, and that perhaps in celebration, that's when he constructs this four-story factory, which is where it is now. Now, unfortunately, in the 20s, there was a disgruntled employee who decided to light up the paint room, unfortunately. So that destroyed most of the factory, and they had to rebuild it in the 20s. Yeah, blew it up. But that was the year that he constructed that magnificent building. And, of course, in 1884, we also have our fire insurance plan that tells us about the boundary and the urban area of the village of Ayr, including those amalgamated areas. So sort of as closing, I mean, we do have our amalgamation in 1884, but I really think it wasn't until the early 1900s that you really start seeing that consolidation and unified village. We know that at least until the early 1900s, people still used Jedburgh. I don't know if it's the same with Cambridge, but you say Galton, Hesper, and Preston. But eventually, maybe it was because we had a new generation at that point in time, but you see sort of the disappearance of the use of the name Jedburgh by 1905. And in 1911, Clark's Mill. Now, Clark ran the Nithville Mill for a very long time. He passes away in 1911. It's closed, opens briefly with Mr. Upton, who produces the Pride of the Nith, the flower there. That closes in the 20s. And then you see the disappearance of that name as well. So to this day, some people might not know that Nithville and Jedburgh did exist. So I am here at the closing because I'm going to get cut off, but I want to cut into other people's time. Lots to talk about. In 1973, of course, we became part of Waterloo Region. And if we look at the air-urban boundary today, because I'm a planner and that's what I'm going to do and bore you guys with, but we can see, obviously, that our boundary has certainly changed. We have development on several areas north of Nithville, north of Jedburgh, and south in the hilltop area. So we're growing as a diverse community, which is certainly something to celebrate. So I'm going to close here with a quote that I have from Andrew Taylor's Today's and Yesterday's. He says, "Community spirit is not the recent discovery so many social workers would have us believe. Ayr seems to always have had it. Of course, there have been many family quarrels, bitter and long, Jedburgh versus Ayr, upper village against lower, church and school fights. I got to hear about these. But they were always united against the world. So I like to think that we're strong, we're persistent, even in the face of things like tornadoes. We continue to grow as a community with a diverse mosaic of people. And it's an honor to be here on its 200th year anniversary to see where we came from and also excited to see where our future will lead." Thank you very much.
Just before Rich Mills thanks, thank you for the wonderful presentation today. 300 years of Ayr history in North Dumfries history in 25 minutes. I'd say that's a record. At the big event on the holiday weekend for the 200th anniversary, the great-great-granddaughter of Abel Mudge was here. Came from down in Michigan somewhere. She was so thrilled, got toured around. She had a great time. And the last thing I'll make mention of, I always knew that there were bandits at Black Horse Corners. Rich, yours.
I guess I'm the guilty one that forced Rachel to condense her original longer history into the short one. So perhaps at some point in the future we can give her an hour and a half to really do the full level. So don't throw your notes out. So here's a token of thanks from Waterloo Historical Society and North Dumfries as well. A copy of our most recent volume.
and a little token of thanks. So, Rachel, it was great to meet you again after, I don't know, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I met you, and I'm sure you see a lot of familiar faces out there as well. So, thanks again.
Were there any questions for Rachel? I forgot to ask. Is there anyone who wants to ask her a question? Jeff, do you have a question? Black Horse Corner Bandit. Okay, we're going to take 10 minutes. Try to keep it to 10. We'll start right back here as soon as we get most of the people seated. Ken Sealing is going to give us a show. Aren't you, Ken? No pressure. Okay, thanks. Take a break. Thank you. Two or three more minutes, please. If you could take your seats, we'll get back. Ask everyone to take their seats, please. If you need to finish up anything, there'll be time afterwards as well. Just make it to your seats, please. Please make it to your seats.
Ladies and gentlemen, can you hear us?
I think they can hear me. Hey?
The bell? Whistle?
Okay, thank you. Thanks for getting back.
I'd like to make one more announcement afterwards with Mark.
Would you like to do it before? We'll do it before. So just hang on there a second.
Here, introduce Marg Rule.
Marg.
Yeah, I just say, she was talking about the bus tours they're organizing.
Okay. We've got a little announcement before we get back into the program from Marg.
Good evening. I'm Marg Rohl, the president of the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario North Waterloo Region Branch. We are having a bus tour to visit four heritage conservation districts. The date is Saturday, October the 5th from 9 to 5. We'll meet at Victoria Park. It'll be an enhanced school bus. The districts that we are going to see are Victory Houses in the St. Mary's Hospital area, Upper Dune, New Hamburg, and lunch at the Scran and Dram, a Scottish public house in New Hamburg, and Greenfield. The cost for members is $50, non-members is $60. Non-members can register after September 25th. That gives our members a chance to do that. Some people have already registered, and I should mention the cost. It is $50 for members and $60 for non-members, and the non-members can register after September 25th. I may have mentioned that. At any rate, it's an incentive to become a member. So if you're interested, I'll be around, and I'll take your name and email address, and we'll email you all the details. It should be a really good trip. Oh, and the trip leader is Warren Stoke. You know him, so yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you. And I think Warren's here at the back as well, aren't you, Warren? Wave, Warren, so they know who you are. Thank you. Mark, as a former teacher and school administrator, I'm very pleased that you went with the enhanced school bus. Because the rest of them are difficult. Just a couple things before John introduces our next speaker. If you are a resident in North Dumfries, I would strongly ask, encourage you to join up with our organization if you can. If you have any interest at all, it's only $20. Kim's looking after it. So if you haven't done that and you'd like to, please do that before you go. The topic for this next discussion is not the history of AIR and North Dumfries. It's what do you do with the history of AIR and North Dumfries. In other words, once you find things, what do you do with them? Where do you put them? How do people access them? How can they look at them? How can they get a hold of them? And that's what we do as an organization, and we do a lot of it. We've been doing it for about, 10 years, 11th year now, and we're at the point where our collection is large, and we're looking for space, we're looking for opportunity to either house the archives in a place where it's more accessible for the public and or where we can show the materials and displays that we have. So that's partly where this is going today. Ken is going to talk to us a little bit about the museums specifically and alternative visions of that as well. So I'll turn it over to John and he'll introduce.
All right, thank you. And what an impressive crowd we've got tonight. Used up all our chairs. That's great on there. So our next speaker here is Mr. Sealing, and he is somebody that everyone would recognize here for his long term as the chairman of the Region of Waterloo from 1985 through to 2018. And I don't think you ever lost an election, did you? Yeah, isn't that impressive after all that? And so Ken's been a resident of the Region of Waterloo or Woolwich Township all his life as well. And I think we're so fortunate to have Ken, because over his many years in politics, I saw him at many a farm meeting. He made a point of getting around the region to all these small-type gatherings here. So as a result, we get to know him quite well. Would you please help me introduce Mr. Ken Sealing.
Well, thanks, John. And after listening to Dave's introduction, I have to go back and rewrite my speech, I think. Anyway, it's great to be here. I always tell people that people say, how's retirement? And I say, so-so. Because I do miss the life. And one of the things I miss the most is getting out with people like yourselves and groups like this. Getting out among the community was the highlight of the job for me. And I always enjoyed it because there was so much good work going on in the community, regardless. And I used to go to the big things, but I always made a point of going to smaller group events because some people, they feel unappreciated. But they have to know that people value what you do. And I think that's really important. And things like this are part of that. It's what makes a community. And it's really important. It was always very important to me. And I hope my successors can do the same sorts of things, because you have to understand your community in order to govern it properly. So I also had a laugh. I just got a chuckle when I talked about the Scots who came to make whiskey, because it reminded me of my heritage. I always tell people that I'm one of the typical Waterloo County blends. I'm two parts German, one part Mennonite, and one part Scotch. And my Scottish lineage came to Winterburn in the 1830s and are listed as whiskey makers. People have said to me, Ken, if you had to write your obituary, What would you say are the things that were most important that you had a hand in doing over those years? And there are a number of things I'd list. And one of the obvious ones would be the growth management strategy, the farmland protection, the LRT, the ION, the no smoking bylaw, things like that. But also on my list are two items that I think are really important to me. One is the creation of Historic Sites Division within the Region of Waterloo, which brought significant investments when we started that, I wasn't the chair at the time. I was a member of regional council, but convinced Jim Gray at the time it was importance of doing that. And we went from a budget of about $200,000 within 2 or 3 years to $11 million on heritage activities. And the other thing that's on my list, which may or may not surprise you, is the Wellington County Museum and Archives. Because I was hired, and I'll get into that a little bit later, I was hired to create that, and the creation of the archives rates high. And I'll speak to that a little bit later. So to understand where I'm coming from on some of this whole topic of where are things best kept, where are things best displayed, who does what, and that sort of thing, you have to understand a bit of my personal history, because my personal history sort of has built my views on this sort of thing. And I might have to admit that my views have been changed in the last few years, but I want you to understand a little bit about my background and why I've done the things I've done. Early on, I had an early interest in history. I can remember in elementary school reading about Schliemann at Troy and Carter in Egypt. And in grade 8, I wrote a project on the history of Elmira. It was my school project for grade 8. And I went through high school being a particular interest in history. So when I went to university, I went to a university which was once called Waterloo Lutheran University. It's now Wilfrid Laurier. And I was in the honors history program. And we had to, in those days, I'm sure if it's still the case or not, in your fourth year, you had to write a thesis. And so I had to write an honors thesis. And so I had a faculty advisor by the name of Dr. Charles Poppe. Now, there may be some people in this room who remember Dr. Charles Poppe. And Dr. Poppe, he came out of Pennsylvania, but he was really an interesting chap because he believed that if you really wanted to study history, you had to study original primary sources. You could read all the secondary books in the world, but you really hadn't done true research until you'd done primary research. And so he said, well, where are the fields of doing primary research? And he said, well, I'm a firm believer in doing local history. So let's pick a topic that takes you into local history. So my topic, this was in 1968, was historic buildings in Bridgeport. Some of you may recall that back in the mid-60s, They began building inventories across the province of Ontario, inventorying historic buildings. And so this sort of fit right into that theme. And so I spent the year researching the buildings in Bridgeport. And I can tell you it was a bit of an exercise because everything was so scattered. I was into the Ontario Archives. I went to the registry offices. Back in those are the days when the registry office was still there and they still had regular original documents in the registry office. You could find your local stuff here in town. I interviewed local people. I spent time with Gray Schmidt at the library and the archives there. Interestingly enough, nobody ever pointed me to the County of Waterloo, which still existed at that time. But it was a new building, and everything was brand new, and so I guess the people didn't think it existed. I went to the old Township of Waterloo offices, which still existed, and they sent me out to the garage to see these stacks of papers and say, we have a few things out there. We don't know what's there. And I did all of that over the year and wrote a thesis on the buildings of Bridgeport. And interestingly enough, that was, believe it or not, 55 years ago. I think I have the only honors history thesis done at Wilfrid Laurier University that's still used today. I had a call this year for a woman, Kate, can I borrow your 1969 thesis? And there it is, full of maps, pictures, drawings, genealogical charts, all sorts of things. And when I had to do my examination, the faculty examination, the other faculty members thought, well, this isn't a valid topic. And so my thesis advisor spent the whole examination defending it. I sat there and listened to it and passed my thesis. So, but it got me really, really intrigued with local history so that when I started teaching 2 years later, I was hired. I taught at Waterloo Collegiate. And I taught the grade 10 history course. I was the main teacher of grade 10 history. And grade 10 history at that time was Canadian history. So I built in a unit of local history. And my friend Warren back there convinced me to get my bus driver's license, as he had one, because he was teaching at Eastwood. And I would take my students out on the road in a bus, and we would visit cemeteries, look at buildings, visit communities, look at the Mennonite community, all sorts of things in local history. And so that local history bug was still with me. And I was involved with at that time, I went to the Waterloo Historical Society meetings. I got involved in the Heritage Foundation. And after 3 years of teaching, I thought, well, I'd like to try something else. I have my permanent certificate now. And lo and behold, there was an ad in the paper one day for a curator for the Wellington County Museum. So I applied, no experience other than some other than some background in doing local history. I think because they were all farmers in county council. They knew my grandfather. I think that's how I got the job, actually. But I was hired in July of 1974, and within 12 months, we moved the little part-time museum of Laura into the old county home for the age between Fergus and Laura, converted that into a museum, and began operations there. That was a quick learn for me. And I learned a lot of things, and I remember that at the time, one of the designers came out for the opening ceremonies and said, you know, this is the plummiest of the plums. You're really showing off the history of the county. So that was my move into the local history field, but it also took me into other areas of local history in Wellington County. And it became very clear that materials were all over the county. Archival types of materials. We had a few that came with the collection, but we started to acquire some of them. And I thought, well, what are we going to do here? And at that time in Wellington County, there were 21 municipalities. This is pre-reform. And there were 21 municipalities. And so a lot of them had records stashed all over the place. And I thought, this is crazy. So what we did was that at that time, there were only two collection sources in the county at that time. One was at the Guelph Public Library, where the little Wellington County Historical Society had their little collection, and the University of Guelph was actively collecting. John Moldenhauer was over there collecting at that time. And I thought, this is crazy. We can't allow all this stuff to go all over the place. So I created the Wellington County Archives as part of our operation. That Wellington County Archives, if anybody's been over there, now is one of the finest municipal archives in Ontario, if not Canada. Because what I did was I spent a lot of time going around the area municipalities saying, we need to gather up at least the municipal records and not any other things and make a safe place and home operated under archival standards for this. And so our first room for the Wellington County Archives was the men's dining room in the Wellington County home built in 1871. It then moved to the basement of the 1954 edition. And as I was leaving to come to Waterloo at that time, we had just started the renovation to create a true archival home over there. And if you go over there today, they've expanded that even further. And so they were successful in consolidating. So if you go to Wellington County today, there are no multiple sources. The university has some, and I'm sure the city of Guelph has some, but without across the county, everything's sort of gathered and focused in the Wellington County Museum. So if you're doing research at Wellington County, you can go to one place and basically find everything that you need. It's all there. And we did all those sorts of things. And one of the other major sources was the Tweedsmuirs. And so we found a way of gathering up the Tweedsmuirs as well so that they became available in one location. So I think that the need for centralization and consolidation and proper management and story of archival collections was critically important. And I want to share just some stories of things that happened that you might find interesting because they relate to Waterloo. And so during the latter years that I was there, I was actually working both sides of the line. I was the mayor of Woolwich and a regional councillor. At the same time, I was the director of the Wellington County Museum. I had a special deal with them. When I was a councillor and I ran for mayor, I said to them, look, I said, we're short-staffed. We need staff at the museum. If you let me run for mayor over on the Waterloo side, because I was on the other side of the line, and have the freedom to come and go as I need, I'll give up half my salary, but I'll still do the full-time job. And so for 7 years, they got two people on one salary. I got the freedom to do things on both sides of the line. And it allowed me to dabble in a lot of archival and other things on both sides of the line. And I just want to talk about two stories about by chance and importance of archival materials. So while I was at Wellington, I don't know if anybody's seen the Wellington County Courthouse across from St. George's Church in Guelph. It was built in 1841. It was the District of Wellington. Waterloo Region was part of the District of Wellington in those days in 1841. And they had the same rules as in the 1850s. To be declared a governing body, you had to build a jail and a courthouse. So the jail and the courthouse were built in 1841. And the county was there in the early 1980s trying to decide whether to move or to restore. And they made a decision to do an adaptive restoration of the courthouse. And I was charged with doing the research for it. Well, I hunted high and low for materials and records. And I hunted all over and I couldn't find the district minute books. Except one day, one of the Reeves on County Council with Reeve Pilkington said to me, I'm involved in the library world, and there's a man from Milton, and he says he has books from our area. So I called the guy, and he said, yeah, I have all these Minute books. He said, I was in the courthouse one day back in the 1950s, and there was this stack of books at the back door, and they seemed to be going to the garbage, so I just took them home. They were all the original Minute books from 1841 to 1852. For the District of Wellington, which he had actually literally stolen. So I talked to him a little bit, and I thought, no, there's two options here. One is I can get our lawyer to go after him and return it, or we can do it this nicely, because if you start threatening people, materials go underground. So back then, we paid him $450. We got all the District of books back, and so they're now in the Wellington County archives. But they are the Minute books for this area too, because Waterloo County was part of the District of Wellington. And so that's really important. Some of the other records turned up in Rochester. A lady named Laura bought them at a book sale, and she bought the treasurer's books in Rochester at a book sale down there. I guess some of them traveled down there, and we went around. And I came over to Waterloo thinking, when I was doing my search, thinking, well, perhaps, because Waterloo was there, maybe in the transition they got books as well. They had Minute books there. Well, as you know, in 1964 the original courthouse was demolished and a new courthouse was built. And so by the early 80s the county was long gone, and said, we don't know anything about that, but here, we'll open the old vault. There's some old vault. The vaults in the 1964 courthouse are down there. Why don't you go down and take a look and see what you can find down there? Well, I went down there, and lo and behold, nothing much. Let me just step back. One step back. The other thing that happened when I was doing their search was that I found the caretaker in the 1950s when this was all taking place. And he said, oh, he said, Ken, he said, they were renovating in the 1950s, and I remember I carried stuff over to the boiler in the jail for 3 days. But these books got stolen and saved in the process. Anyway, so I went down to the vaults in the 1964 courthouse, and I'm scrounging away there, and I pull some stuff back, and there, lo and behold, there are all these volumes wrapped in paper, in brown and craft paper. Open them up. There is a totally complete set of assessment rolls from 1853 to when the county stopped keeping collection rolls, somewhere in the early 1900s. The total, which I could have used in my research back in 1969, but they were there and they had been saved. So anybody looking for assessment rolls and doing historical property research, you should know that those records are now in the regional archives and were saved. But some of this stuff comes up by chance. And you'll find that in the local collections as well. So I did the research on the jail. It was interesting. We had Minute books from the county. We had early records that we'd found and none of other things. And if anybody has seen the book Early Courthouses of Ontario by Tony Adamson and Marion McRae, you may recognize those names, those who follow architecture. There's a whole chapter on the Wellington County Courthouse, ostensibly written by Marion McRae and Tony Adamson, but really written by me. There's a small little footnote at the very end of the book where they add insult and injury, they spelt my name wrong. So part of my background is the idea of consolidating archival holdings for a variety of reasons, for access, for professional care, just all the good practice that's available. But so in Wellington, we were able to get 21 municipalities all over time, and even after I left, to consolidate some of their materials. And I also watched, when I was still at Wellington, I watched some efforts at local efforts to do things at the local community level. And they weren't very sophisticated. And this goes back, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s. I can think of one little small incorporated town in Wellington County that decided they had a local group that wanted to preserve local materials. They found the empty creamery building, gathered up artifacts, gathered up archival materials, and there it sat in that building. The group aged out, for starters. They had no financial support. I don't know what ended up with the materials, but it sort of stuck in my mind the dangers of local operations which aren't adequately funded or financed or professionally run or mandated. So that's helped shape some of my thinking on what goes on locally. so when I moved to the region as the chair in 1985, well, actually before 1985, Jim Gray was the chair, and I worked with Jim Gray to try and to try and consolidate the heritage activities in the region, and we did. We brought Schneider House, we brought Dune, and ultimately McDougall Cottage into the envelope and run by the region, properly financed, properly staffed. One of the early hires we had is sitting right in the front row. We hired Sue Burke, who did the, well, actually we hired Sue prior to the takeover, but we were still funding part of it, to do the Joseph Schneider House restoration, one of the best, I think, restoration projects that was in Ontario at the time and still today. I still think that's the case. And so we did that, but I also took a look at whether we could find a way of centralizing archival holdings in Waterloo region as we had done in Wellington County. But it became obvious early on that that wasn't possible. There were just too many established archives there. There was the Kitchener Public Library, the Gray Schmidt Room was doing their things there, and the Historical Society had their holdings there. Cambridge had established an archive right at the time of amalgamation. Wilfrid Laurier was collecting. The seminary was collecting. University of Waterloo was actively collecting. Wellesley had their own little thing up in the schoolhouse up there. So there were just too many bodies out there to create a centralized archives. And so that sort of had to pass by, and the opportunity was long missed, but unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view. And I also, my other bit of experience that I had during that period of time was that I was involved in the Ontario Museum Association. I served a couple of years as president, and Sue was also on that body as well. And we saw a whole range of museums and archival holdings across the province of Ontario, some very good, some not very good. And in terms of preservation and access to those sort of things, some of those criteria were never met. So how does that all come together in what I'm talking to you about tonight? Well, it sort of shaped my thinking on it over the years. And how does the project here in North Dumfries fit into all this? So we do know now that there are many projects on the go in the region. There is the one here, there's Cambridge Archives, Waterloo has a museum, Wellesley has the schoolhouse, their holdings, Wilmot has the Castle Kilbride, and yours here. Some of them are simply archival, some of them are artifact-based, and some of them are a mix of things. So, in looking forward, where do we go going into the future with all of this? 10 years ago, I would have had a different point of view, but I think my point of view has shifted. I'm going to explain why. I think the first step was we need to have criteria where these things should operate and how they should operate. They should be safe and proper storage. They accepted standards of documentation and handling. The ability to display, accessibility for research, and sustainable and long-term operations. They have to be sustainable. Going forward. If they don't meet those criteria, then I don't think they should exist, quite frankly, because I think you're at risk of losing more than you're saving. And first of all, I would distinguish between artifact and archival collections. In the case of artifact collections, these are real objects which tell the story of a community and which are worthy of preservation. I actually wrote the last page of my speech because I wanted to say the right things properly. They're real objects which tell the story of a community and which are worthy of preservation. And if you have the criteria which I've listed, if they can be met, then there's a good case for collections telling a community story. With the cooperation that exists between various operations, heritage operations, there now is the ability to borrow or loan items from various collections, which I think is good. I do think the operations in this region meet most, if not all, of these criteria. Perhaps the greatest threat to some in some of the organizations is actually the aging population and the aging out of volunteers who make some of this work possible. And I don't think historical societies are any different than service clubs, churches, or anything else where the demographic is really impacting. And so that has to be taken into account when you're doing these sorts of things, whether they're sustainable or not. I think they can be sustainable. It's just like everything else, drawing in younger people and making sure they know how to do this job. Archival collections I see in a somewhat different light. In Waterloo region, the ability to have a centralized archives is not possible, at least at the municipal level, with the current governance framework that we have. Centralized accessibility remains a problem for researchers, and the reliance on volunteers and limited budgets would seem to be a problem, or could be a problem for some. proper preservation and accessibility therefore means that there must be adequate local support for archival practices and for researcher accessibility. This is one area where I think technology can play an increasingly important role. I remember well when we thought we were in heaven when we were first able to get money for microfilming. Now, I'm not sure anybody here ever knew how the old microfilm machines worked. They were quite the show. And you had to get the books in the right place and the right pictures. And if you ever worked with microfilm, I bet you 20% of the microfilms that you have today are illegible. You can't read them, or the edges, you can't read the edges and that sort of thing. But we thought we were heaven when microfilm came along. Now, scanning, searching, and electronic transmission are widely used, and I think they can play an important role for smaller community archives, which will then ensure the preservation, albeit in a different format, and research access. It can also provide, really, ultimately, for a virtual single archive region-wide. If everybody was able to scan and commit to electronically preserving the records, and this is all merged and searchable, we could have a single archives for the whole region done that way without having to move materials or have a centralized archives. I think one advantage of localized collections is the community contact they provide. Finding or receiving local photographs, papers, business records, and other things that might not find a home if people didn't think that we're staying local. And you and I know, or those who've worked in the field know, that quite often some of the caches come out of houses and people will say, this is my mother's thing or my grandmother's thing, what do I do with it? And you know, they don't have a sense of where things go, but if there's somebody local they can talk to, there's an opportunity to do things there. So to summarize my journey and experiences over the years, this has led me to support more centralized and accessible. My original position was to support more centralized and accessible artifact and archival collections. However, more recently, it's becoming possible to see smaller community sites and programs operating successfully if the criteria can be met and if there is adequate financial support to ensure the sustainability. That line I wrote for Sue.
The other Sue, right?
Yes. Because at the end of the day, financial support is critical to the whole thing. And I just take a look at what a difference when the region took over the sites, what that meant in terms of the operation of the regional sites and the ability to do things. And so that's true here. If you're not sustainable, you don't have the resources to do it, and you collect these things and you end up destroying them or having them destroyed or not looked after or not accessible, you aren't doing anything anyway. So I think there's a lot of good intentions. I think there's a lot of criteria that you all can meet. From what I'm seeing right now, I think the group down here is trying to meet all of those criteria. And I think with good support, they will continue to do good work. And they can all fit into this network, this virtual archival network that ultimately should be built across the region. And that means that local collections are possible then, as long as we've got the ability to access them and maintain them. So if I may be allowed to make a bit of a political comment, I think that going forward, these community memories, as I call them, will become important as governance changes come someday, because surely they'll come. And the importance of community and its history becomes doubly important. So with that, I've bored you long enough. Thanks for listening. So I forgot. One thing I wanted to mention was that part of the local archival holdings, I think you should make a real effort. I just brought this along because this is the Freundschaft book for my mother's family. And in every community, there's lots of family histories and lots of genealogical studies that are being done and sitting on shelves in homes or otherwise. And some of the local organizations can become the homes of these, because when people are looking for them, there has to be a centralized place to find them. So I just brought this along because this is the updated Freundschaft book for my mother's family. And anyway, it's just an example of what can be done.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Don't go away from that.
Get my stuff out of here.
That's okay.
Just to make a point of the family histories Ken mentioned, we have 31 written family histories in our vault, in our storage. 31 histories that go back 200 years in some cases, here in North Dumfries and in Ayr, in all of the communities. access is an issue. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I wanted to just quote Ken on a very important point here, and I want to do it in a similar fashion. Financial support is important. Sue? I just couldn't resist, Sue. What a remarkable historic background Ken has, right from university. By the way, we were both graduates of the history program, but different universities. And I didn't do a thesis. We didn't have to, so I was happy with that. He's been interested in this his whole life and his whole career. And even as regional chair, it was a priority for him, as he mentioned in some of the examples that he used. And it's important to have leadership that values this, promotes this, and helps to encourage and preserve it. So we thank you for that. We thank you for your speech tonight. I really appreciated the personal reflections that you had, the personal experiences, and I thought your concept of archives and museums for small communities was really right on the spot. Profound. We have technology now that allows us to do these kinds of things, but we have to have the will, we have to have the people, the volunteers who are interested to do the work. We have virtually our entire collection online. Am I correct, Irene?
Pretty much.
You would have some difficulty accessing some of it because we don't have software programs that really set it up in such a way that it's easily found and easily managed. So what Ken's talking about really is an important next step for all of us who have interest in local history. You've been a leader in this community for a long time. I'm not sure why people don't call you Mr. Museum.
They did?
Well, thank you, Mr. Museum. Here I thought I was being creative. For all that you've done and all that you've said tonight, thank you very much. I have just a couple little things here for you. First of all, a special Air 200 hat. The value priced calendar. And a complimentary membership in our organization. Just a few things to talk about before we finish up here tonight. The copying of information is important. We started very much like Ken described earlier on, and that was with things like the Tweedsmuir histories. We have all the Tweedsmuir histories from North Dumfries in our collection. We have records of North Dumfries that are not in our collection because they are in complementary groups like the region and like Cambridge or Galt, and it's not coordinated. So we don't have a place for a way in which to coordinate that. We don't have a place for people to come and coordinate that. And we've been talking with the township for a while on this thing, and we're still talking and still hoping that we're going to find some solution to this down the road. We have the very first minute book ever written of North Dumfries Township. And you can read it yourself. Day one, first page, it's all there. So there's a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff's in terrible condition. When we started this, we rescued, basically, the township municipal record collection from the basement of the old township office. It's the old stone school. In a closet full of mold, which reeked like you wouldn't believe. We had to bag it, we had to box it, we put it in the truck, we took it to the arena, they hated it, it smelled so bad. The township has committed to putting about 15 grand in a year to clean that material, and slowly we're working our way through it. So I want to put a couple questions to you, if I might, that will help us as a newly incorporated organization make our first steps in this new configuration. How does the North Dumfries Historical Preservation Society become more visible to you? What would make it more visible to you? What can we do that would allow you to recognize that we're here and to engage with us in some form? And I don't mind silence. I was a teacher a long time. Anyone? How did you find out about this tonight? Internet. For us to contact you for internet, we have to have your email. So if you join tonight, we'll have your email. If you don't join tonight and you're interested, then leave us your email and we'll send you some stuff to try and encourage you over a period of time. We want you to see us. We want you to tell us how or what you need to see us. Do you want something in the air news from us? Do you want more events like this? Do you want us to just disappear and go away? Maybe you do. Is there any comment from anyone on that? Yes, please.
I think another way that a lot of, especially the smaller groups, and it's not necessarily a historical group, but whatever group it is that can fit in, if they go to the larger groups that do have a website, like the region, and then from the region into their heritage section, and there be listed as one of their, like a...
Okay, so a link, in other words.
Link.
Yeah.
And the same with the Waterloo Historical Society. We do have a number of other groups that you can link to through our website. And if all the groups were doing that, it would be pretty cool, because somebody's going to be doing research, and they're going to say, oh, I never thought about it.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a simple point. Rich.
Dave, one of the ideas I had when they were forming the Waterloo Region Museum was traveling exhibits around the region.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing ever came of it. You're a more compact area, so maybe you had a traveling exhibit, easily changed. You could run down to Branson, you could run over to, you know, I can't even name any more committees.
Black Horse Corners, where the bandits are, yes.
Set up on a Saturday afternoon, or set up at an event.
Yeah, that's a nice idea. Just to be visible.
And have a showcase display. You mentioned it earlier. A little display area you hope to get. I think that's incredibly important. Right where people go.
We have at least one display, I know, at the arena. Old hockey outfits, old hockey teams.
How about Heritage Day? Lauren will tell you all about Heritage Days. And how we used to go. And he was advertised through the GRC, the whole GRC watershed. And it was a packed house, and there were wonderful events, which I'm hoping that he's going to bring back again. But let's have a heritage take over the whole NDCC floor, you know, the hall, and have the heritage day with displays and speakers on each event. Ken can come talk. I hear he's retired.
Yes.
Well, I have to agree on that. So I'm Dan. I look after the Cambridge Archive.
Yes, you look familiar. Thank you.
We did a similar thing a few years ago. We did the Heritage Day in Cambridge thing, so we brought together a bunch of different heritage groups. Social media and community outreach are key, because nobody knows I'm there. So you got to get out there and be visible, especially using social media and technology.
You have full-time staff, do you?
You're looking at it. That's and,
it's I'm just asking.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You're looking at the staff. Okay. It's not all the time, unfortunately. It is what it is. I make the best of what we have. But yeah, getting out there and getting involved in the community, doing events, stuff like this, that's huge.
Okay. Mark, did you have your hand up?
Yes. Wilmot Township has had a Heritage Day for many years.
Yes.
And it's during Heritage Week on a Saturday, and they've been very successful. We've had different themes and topics, and we've had a lot of people come. And so if anybody wants to contact me or talk to me, I can maybe help them with a Heritage Day, but I'm sure you know what you're doing. But it works. It's a really good idea.
Thank you. Mayor Foxon?
I've gone to that, and it is excellent. I've gone several times. And they lay out all the archives, and you walk down those
mm-hmm. We displayed there at least once, I know, in the past. So, yes, sir.
Mike Harris, did you
come? I'm sorry?
Mike Harris.
Oh! Is he going to send us money, do you think? Let me just ask maybe one more question. I want to belabor this, but especially for those who are here from the North Dumfries air region, is there a need for this?
Yes.
Do people want this? Yes. Do they want it to be visible? Do they want to be able to touch it? Do they want to be able to look at it? Is there importance to it? Because, frankly, if it's just a matter of storing it, We can look after that. But if people want to access it, we can't do it in the format and structure we have now. Yes, Irene?
Yeah. I listened to some points. I just want to talk.
Just speak up a bit, Irene.
I just want to respond to a few points that Ken made about incorporating all of the different organizations in the region. If you look at the North Humphreys Preservation website, we have included the region of Water and Park Fires. We have 7 or 8 links, so we have already linked everybody up as well as we can. And so that I was just responding to Debbie. But the other thing about it is, so using technology, I think that in using the members that we have done our best to link in with other people digitally, because that's all we can do. And I guess I think if we want membership, or if we want people to come out and help, if we want young people to come out and help, they're interested in technology. But we have lots of technological things they could help us with. But where are we going to come to? Right now, we meet at the yoga room at the North Dundee Community Complex. When it's not being used for yoga, if you want to look at our archives, they're in a closet. They're in a closet, they're in the Sage Barn, they're at the Air News, they're spread all over because we have nowhere to put them. So, frankly, I'm embarrassed to ask people to come out as a member because we have nowhere for you to come. Now, another thing Ken talked about was money. I think that means money was money. Well, we should have had access to a lot of money that was left to the township by Thomas Taylor. Unfortunately, he left the township, I'll say $300,000, the year we had our first meeting. He didn't know about us. So the money went to the region. It went to the regional library system, and it was being frittered away until we put a stop to that. It was to be used to preserve North Dumfries history. Well, it was used to buy bicycle racks, ceiling tiles, so we put a stop to that. So now there's about $120,000 left of that money. So not really wanting to stand here and whine about where can we meet. We've reached out to the region, we've reached out to the library committee, we've reached out to anybody that will listen. And we said, I'm sure, oh, we reached out to Thomas Taylor's family and said, could we take that $120,000 and renovate the Air Library and have a nice space for the North Humphreys Archives? And everybody said yes, except the Waterloo Region Library Committee. They pretty much told us we can't have that money. And we do have a little bit of money of our own, thanks to the generosity of other members of the Taylor family. So this is where we're stuck. And this is where we're trying to advance. It took us about a year, but we joined the Ontario Historical Society. This is a step toward being able to take charitable donations on our own, to be arm's length from the township. We've done that. We've bought cloud space. We're scanning our archives. We're doing as much as we can with the members that we have. But the point that we need is to be able to meet. I'll have Megan answer soon. We'll be able to meet not through Zoom or not in the yoga room at the North Humphreys Community Complex. So I just wanted to let. And the other thing I wanted to talk about very briefly is.
Please.
Building archives, because archives are a Watson plow or Watson, but to me they don't just, we're not just building archives. By bringing people from, we're also building the community. Because people can come out on a Sunday afternoon, go downtown there, get an ice cream, and maybe come and see some of the fantastic donations that we have that are spread all over the township because we have nowhere to put them. So it's not just about building up this bricks and mortar and all these reams of paper. It's about building community. So
good point.
I think that that's the last piece of the puzzle. And you can tell I'm a little bit frustrated. But Sue's going to help me with my frustration.
How actually we never came to the library committee. Library staff. We're the ones staff.
And what I'll say to that, Sue, is that we asked repeatedly from the meeting, we were told no.
write it up for me, and I will take it to the library committee as a motion.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you very much for that. So you get a sense of where we are. Once again, just a little bit of contrariness to a point Irene's made. I am not embarrassed to ask people to be members. I think the more members you have, the more minds you have, the more minds you have, the more creative you are, the more hands you have to build and to do things. So if it's of interest to you, please sign up, or at least leave us an email. We can contact you. I want to say thanks to everybody for being here tonight and for all of your help and support, especially for the Waterloo Historical Society. For me, it's been a nice night. I really enjoyed the speakers. They've been great. Irene, are you going to wrap up for me, or... You're done, are you? All right, we'll just wrap it up here. So again, it's all right. Bar's still open. Cheese is still on the table. So is the coffee. You know what I liked about the intermission? You were all talking to each other. And is there anything better than the kind of networking when you get a chance to talk to people with similar interests? Any day, and they'll look after you. And special thanks to Rachel for an extraordinary journey through the history of North Dumfries and Ayr. And to Ken for putting it all together for us and giving us the challenges that are ahead that we need to think about and we need to face. And thanks to all of you for coming from locally and from afar. We really appreciate that. Thanks, good night, enjoy.